Please sit down. And we can start this evening. Still some people standing there. Okay, thank you.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and on behalf of the Bali and the Dutch Platform for Corporate Social Responsibility, we welcome you to this special edition of the Bali program, How Globalized Are You? This is Maite Somers, my name is Marcia Luyten, and we will be the only girls on stage tonight, and we will chair this meeting. So, on the very day that Shell presented its annual and social report today, we will have all the stakeholders involved on this stage, and we're proud to have them here. We will have a politician, we will have an NGO representative, we will talk with a Shell representative, Shell, who today presented its number 8 social report, as you probably all know, and we will listen to the stories of people who represent their communities, and these people come from all over the world, and they live in places nearby Shell production sites. So that group of people together turns this evening, we think, in an extraordinary event. And we are very keen to learn more about the dilemmas and the problems that come with corporate social responsibility. We are interested in what are the dilemmas and the problems for governments, what are the problems and the dilemmas for Shell, and maybe there are similar dilemmas for the NGOs too. Because that seems to be a matter of fact. It is quite complicated. Good intentions, they're a beautiful thing, but the daily practice seems to be more difficult. Anyway, because of that, our question for tonight will be, can or will multinationals live up to the guidelines of corporate social responsibility voluntarily, or does it have to happen otherwise? Let me tell you our plan for tonight. We will first provide you an introduction of 10 minutes on the state of affairs of corporate social responsibility. After that, we will listen to the stories of 3 people, 3 community members. They will tell about their daily experiences living nearby a Shell production site. And then the third part will be a discussion, the discussion with the politician, the NGO representative, and a Shell representative. To make it really clear, you as the audience will have the opportunity to pose some questions too, but that will be only at the end of this evening, say after 9:30. Okay, let us start with Pieter van der Graag. And he will give you a 10-minute introduction on corporate social responsibility.
And Pieter van der Graag works for an NGO called...
I'll probably explain it myself. I work for IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. That's what this letter stands for. It's now called the World Conservation Union. I work for the Netherlands Committee for that union, which is the network of the Dutch members of IUCN, based in the Netherlands. It involves the Dutch state, it involves nature protection organizations, it involves universities, and we're trying to keep Dutch policy as green as possible. We're also part of the MVO platform, the Dutch CSR platform, coalition, which was set up a few years ago in response to the request from Dutch business and Dutch government to all the NGOs that are working on issues related to corporate responsibility. Please come up with with one view. Please come up with something joint so that we know what we need to be responding to. And that coalition exists out of human rights organizations, environment protection organizations, consumer protection organizations, development organizations, and labor organizations. It's a very broad coalition. I was asked today to give a brief introduction, 10 minutes, of what exists internationally on regulating global corporations. And I was told to do this for people who know a lot about it, who are in the room, and people who know very little about it, who are also in the room. So I'm going to try to please both groups in 10 minutes. So those of you who are experts, you may have heard most of this before. Those of you who are not, I hope I'm not going to go and become too specific or too detailed or too out there and too far away from your real lives. What exists internationally to guide, regulate, or sort of frame the activities of multinational enterprises in broader society, which are our environmental concerns, our social concerns, and our developmental concerns. There are several things, and there are a lot of things that are not there. And I think we'll focus our discussion on what is not there. What's there that most countries actually have national legislation. It is perfectly illegal in India to use child labor, yet it's being used. It's perfectly illegal in Cameroon to cut away trees that should not have been cut away because they're protected or they're too young to be cut away, yet they're being cut away. It's perfectly illegal in Europe to fish for certain species of our coasts, yet every year we know of 8,000 infringements of our own laws. National legislation exists. There is a few problems with national legislation. In a couple of countries, there's corruption. You can buy your way out of laws. There is a lack of capacity to implement. We just don't have enough people trying to enforce those laws. And there's a lack of political will to implement laws. Those are significant issues that exist around national legislation. So we've tried to solve some of that with international agreements, because we've also recognized there are quite a few problems internationally that need to be solved, probably through international cooperation. Yet those international agreements are very difficult to get implemented. Again, there's political will. That's a major problem. There's corruption. There's significant lobbies trying to stop stuff from being implemented. And there is a lack of capacity. Those, I think, are very fundamental issues to why international agreements, which are trying to save our environment, which are trying to stop corporations or people from using child labor, forced labor, trying to bust trade unions, is not taking place. So we've got international laws or agreements to fix those, but they're not being implemented. So there's a response to that. There's a response from government recognizing that they are not doing their jobs very well. They've come up with voluntary norms for corporate behavior. This is also sort of based in this general ideology that markets can fix the problems themselves. We call it neoliberalism. And that's strengthened through rules such as the WTO and bilateral investment treaties, which basically tell governments, step back, society itself, non-governmental organizations, consumers, corporations, they'll try to fix most of those problems through sort of an autonomous process that will help, that will work on itself. So Adam Smith's invisible hand reaching down, and the world will be fine. That's a philosophy, that's an ideology that is clearly alive right now in government. And they've set up rules to protect that ideology in the WTO and in bilateral investment treaties. It's a very significant problem in us trying to come up with proper legislation to deal with issues such as illegal logging, child labor, human rights infringements, etc. So we have this recognition that this isn't working. It's actually recognized by governments. So they've set up a set of norms, principles. And there's quite a few of them that are well known and that are very important. First of all, the International Labor Organization, which is an organization of states, trade unions and corporations, international, they have conventions. They have agreements that governments are supposed to make sure that there's no child labor, there is no forced labor, there is no discrimination in jobs, nothing happens to prevent people from forming trade unions. There's legislation. But already in the 70s, they recognized that most countries, including the United States on trade unions, for example, are not doing a good job making sure that those agreements are actually being translated into real life. So they've set up this tripartite declaration on multinational enterprises, which asks corporations that if government isn't doing it, please you yourselves do it for us. You should respect those four basic core labor standards. Much more recent, Kofi Annan realized that governments are not doing a good job in achieving the Millennium Goals, in achieving Agenda 21. So he set up something called the Global Compact, because much of what Agenda 21 asks for and what the Millennium Goals ask for is a change of the way we do our economy, the way we produce our things, we consume our things. So he set up the Global Compact, asking companies to join with him to do it themselves, because obviously in my view, governments weren't doing their job very well. The OECD, the same thing happened. Already in 1976, all throughout the years, but especially in 1998, the OECD realized that this liberalization agenda was hitting its head on societal opposition to the way corporations were behaving. That was the main motivation why their liberalization agenda was entering into very politically difficult areas. It was becoming difficult to deal with. So they came up with a response called the OECD Guidelines for Multinational Enterprises. I myself worked on those for 2 years with a few other people, and we set up a document, 12 pages, and it describes pretty much everything that's been agreed internationally on how corporations should behave. And what government said, because they're still convinced of this market ideology, corporations, you should, we're not going to tell you that you have to, but you should abide by these expectations that we have formulated for you. Those are the OECD guidelines for multinational enterprises. And they cover things around labor, they cover things around the environment, taxation, competition policy, corporate planning, etc. It's all in there. It's all described. And governments put that out there. Well, we're realizing things are not going very well. These are our expectations for you. The third one that was designed in that period, I covered all three, ILO, Global Compact, and OECD guidelines. At the same time, around 2000, in between now, the OECD started to have difficulties with the idea of voluntarism. Why? Because they were trying to study the effectiveness of policies in achieving sustainable development. And they came up with the idea, they came up with the conclusion that governments are trying to achieve sustainable development through voluntary approaches, nothing binding, no system set up to enforce something, and it was happening. And actually, a very significant conclusion of the OECD in 2004 was the voluntary approach doesn't work, and they are recommending governments in the OECD not to use voluntary approaches anymore to achieve any of these societal goals. They're also still saying, because they're still convinced of that, regulation doesn't work, and then we need to find something between voluntarism and regulation to deal with corporations or with the economy, because that's what they're dealing with. But it's I think it's a very significant discovery. And you could see it coming, because all those systems I just used, the ILO, the OECD, and the Global Compact, have some form of enforcement attached to it. In the ILO, if trade unions think their rights are not being treated properly, they can go to a commission in the ILO, get it judged, and there is some sort of a recommendation to the particular corporation that tells them you should do different things differently. In the Global Compact, most recently, corporations are supposed to be transparent about how they are dealing with the Global Compact, how they are internalizing those 9 principles in their activities. And there is rumors that soon, rumors still, if corporations do not comply with those 9 principles, that they will be asked, friendly-wise, to leave the Global Compact with all the reputational damage that will follow. The OECD guidelines goes first. It's actually set up an office in each government of the 31 member states of the OECD. And each of those offices is supposed to treat complaints from citizens, NGOs, or whomever has an issue with a corporation anywhere in the world coming from the OECD, saying that on the basis of those guidelines, you're not doing your job well. And that was working because the OECD fixed it. In their own view, the governments fixed it. They made the scope, the application of it, so limited that there's very few cases that we can think of that we can enter because the way corporations are organized. The very final instrument that has been developed within the United Nations, and it responds to a lot of these concerns that have come about from these other experiences that we have. And they're the UN norms on business conduct. I don't know the exact title. Maybe you know, Hilke, but I can't remember it exactly. It's a long UN term, long title. But anyway, what it is, it's a long list of treaties, of international agreements that can be translated to the corporation. They've put it into one easy-to-read document. Well, easy-to-read, it's UN-speak, but it's readable. There is a document there, and in that document it is described exactly what in all those treaties that have been agreed, in all those conventions that have been agreed, in all those international systems that we have, what the universal expectations are, universal meaning what we mean on the planet, universe is bigger, but what we mean on the planet, what we expect of our corporations. And they've put it into one easy document. So the conclusion is they have found pretty much everything that should cover the societal expectations of corporations on this planet. They've done one thing, which killed it right away, because governments aren't ready for this. They've added strong enforcement. This is actually my last point, strong enforcement. They've asked that corporations become transparent about what they're doing, and not asked, but they're saying that if this is implemented, they should be forced to be transparent about what they were doing. There should be a system at UN level where people who are affected in their rights or who feel that these standards are not being followed can go to the UN and have it discussed and judged. And third, reparations. If communities are affected wrongly by the corporation, they should be paid. And that's the killer, because governments aren't ready for that, and certainly corporations aren't ready for that one yet, so there's a lobby that's trying to stop that process. But basically what the UN has done, and it's the UN Subcommission on Human Rights, they have come to the point where they have figured out what are the missing elements of all these norms we have. We don't have transparency on what corporations are doing around them, so we need that. We don't have any access to justice. People need to be able to find redress somewhere. And we don't have punishment anywhere. There's a fourth element that I would like to add. Probably to make things a lot less polarized, I think it's a good idea, which is we need more participation. Fundamental to sustainable development is the participatory approach. Everyone in society who has an interest should participate in decision-making, and through that participation we'll get the most optimal policy. Everyone's assets, everyone's knowledge is thrown into the pot, and then we get a decision that isn't limited to one side. We miss that too. The fourth thing, which I think is very important, which is about this treaty system I just talked about, where we made it ourselves very difficult to come up with solid rules to prevent the importation of illegally logged woods, to stop child labor, to stop forced labor, is the WTO and our bilateral investment treaties, or the investment regimes we have. We need to have clarity in those systems on what the role is of these norms and what's more important. And we don't have that right now. It's a long discussion. That's another 10 minutes. I won't do it. But that's actually very fundamental right now to do this entire discussion. We need to stop making it ourselves so difficult to deal with this. Anyway. Yours.
Thank you very much. Okay, before I forget, will everybody put their switch their mobile phones off, because I heard some before and it would be a pity if we would be disturbed, I think. Right now, may I invite our three community members to take place behind this table. Bobby Peake, Norbert George and Isaac Osuoka. First, we're going to speak to with Bobby Peake, and I asked the technicians up there to put on some photographs that have been made. Mr. Peake is the director of Groundwork, Friends of the Earth South Africa, and he grew up in Wentworth, which is in South Durban, and it's situated just among the oil refineries. Mr. Peake, when you are at home and you look out of your window, what do you see?
Bobby, not Mr. Peake. Well, two oil refineries, Shell on the right-hand side, and directly in front of me a Zinja. And from the house that I have, you see these refineries.
Okay. Tell me, there has been presented an alternative report by several NGOs, and you cooperated with this, and there are some differences between what Shell reports on the situation in Durban and what is in the alternative report. Can you just tell us the main differences? What is the factual situation, according to you?
Well, firstly, Shell obviously mentions one side of a particular story. The other side is that they do not mention the underreporting which they have done over the years of sulfur dioxide, which took a decade of activity to get them to admit that. They don't admit that last year they exceeded the World Health Organization guidelines on sulfur dioxide pollution 114 times, and that has a direct impact on the health of our people, where our learners suffer from 52% respiratory and asthma problems. Mm-hmm. They do not reflect on the fact that they have said to us directly they will not replace all the pipelines. We've asked them as a precautionary level that we want all the fuel pipelines that run next to our houses to be replaced. At a precautionary level, they have thrown signs back at us. They have also not told you the fact in the report that Lord Oxbury or Oxbur has come through to South Durban and has admitted...
Who is Lord Oxbur? Just
he's
for people
the chairperson
who don't know.
Of Shell, apologies, mm-hmm. who has come through to South Durban and admitted that the infrastructure of the Shell refinery that was built in 1963 is aging, and mm-hmm. As a result, we're having all these problems. What Shell will tell you is that they're reducing their pollution. Reducing their pollution, they mean only reducing sulfur dioxide at an annual level.
But just to make this not into a Shell tribunal, we're trying to have an honest discussion here. Have they done something, have they tried something good in the last, like, say, 5 years? What have they done? Have they tried?
Well, let me just go, let me go back a step. I just want to talk a bit about today before I tell you what Shell has tried. I discovered today that the Dutch public are very good people. The Dutch public at the AGM turned around and said that the concerns about all the communities are valid, and even if they are not valid, they should be spoken through with Shell. The other important process in that is that we are not going to be able to change how corporates operate, and in Shell particularly, because of an issue called power. No matter what you do, and with due respect to the speakers after me and the speaker before me, unless we dismantle the power of corporations, we are not going to get a change. So Shell will change here and there, but they will not make a meaningful change. And what Shell has done in the South Durban area, finally, just to...
Yeah.
Is that, yes, they have done something. I mean, let's admit, they've reduced SO2 pollution, mm-hmm. which is because we put pressure on them for many years. They will tell you that they're investing 100 million rand in the plant for a cleaner fuel process. Mm-hmm. It's not that they're doing it. It's they have to do it. The government says you will change to cleaner fuels. But finally, what they have done after they had all the environmental problems in the South Durban area is hired PRO people. Mm-hmm. They've hired consultants to try and manage the community when the community comes to them.
Okay. Next question I wanted to put is, can you speak a bit about the role of your government where Shell is concerned?
Well, as we all know, we have a very young democracy, mm-hmm. a democracy of 10 years, a democracy that actually looked to the Netherlands for a lot of support, as well as a lot of guidance, not only at a political level, but also at an environmental governance level. And what your government did, which was harming to our struggle, was that your government said to our government, well, maybe voluntary agreements can work. It took us 4 years of fighting that with organizations like Milieu Defensie, Die Zuid-Hollandse Milieu Federatie, to be able to show our government that voluntary agreements do not work. And why was our government so strong? It wasn't only because of the Dutch government, it was also because Shell, as a Dutch corporation in South Africa, was clearly articulating the point to government that we rather have voluntary agreements.
Okay, so here we have a clear dilemma. I'm sure we will discuss it later. Just now, to conclude this short interview, me and Marcia, we are the two good fairies, and you can make two wishes, one to your government and one to Shell, just in a few words. What would those wishes be?
What do those wishes be now? Mm-hmm. Well, okay, firstly, dismantle the power of corporations. The United States, in the late 1800s, gave what we call corporate personhood to corporations. We need to change that. So if a fairy godmother can do something for me today, is take the power and the rights that corporations have away from corporations. The South African, or I would say the Congress movement in 1955, came up with the Freedom Charter. It said that the people shall govern. The Freedom Charter did not say that corporate shall govern.
Okay, thank you very much.
Our next community member, Norbert George, warm welcome to you too. Norbert George is from Curaçao. He speaks Dutch too, but he will do it in English tonight. Norbert, your case is a particular one, isn't it? Because Shell is no longer active on Curaçao.
Not with the refinery, no, that's correct.
Okay, so then what actually is the problem you're working on?
Well, what happened in Curaçao, and that might, of course, happen still in other communities, is that in 1983, let me give you a bit of a timeline. In 1978, the first health study was published on Curaçao with some devastating conclusions with regard to the effects of the oil industry. And on the island of Curaçao, the oil industry is the refinery.
Be a bit more precise. What kind of effects?
Health effects, all sorts of health effects, asthma, chronic pulmonary diseases, etc. In 1983, Dienst Centraal Milieubeheer Rijnmond came to Curaçao. They conducted a research with regard to the refinery itself, and of course its technical state. And also they came with some rather harsh conclusions with regard to the old age of the refinery, the a lot of maintenance in the last two and a half decades.
Because it was the oldest refinery in the Western Hemisphere?
In the Western Hemisphere. Well, not only the oldest, but I think that is also important to state, one of the biggest refineries in the Western Hemisphere, on an island of 444 square kilometers, and with a downwind community of approximately 12.5% of the total population of Curaçao, which then, of course, lived in the so-called high-risk area. In 1984, Shell announced that it wanted to retreat. It had all sorts of thoughts with regard to the need to retreat. One was their relationship with Venezuela and the price of oil and some other international developments.
Okay, but let's get to 2005.
Well, which led to the retreat of the Shell in 1985. As of 1985, Curaçao and its economy fell into a structural social economic crisis, which has made the island more and more dependent of a refinery that, if you look at it bluntly and economically, it should get rid of. Nowadays it's being rented by the Venezuelan oil company, the state's oil company called PDVSA, and the current situation, 2005, is based on the latest health reports, 4 premature deaths per year and 7,000 people with chronic pulmonary diseases.
Do you consider Shell still responsible for that?
Well, we are in a lucky situation that we form part of the Dutch kingdom, and we have kilos of documents with regard to the retreat of Shell, and we know that Shell is responsible, because Shell knew upfront, one, that the island of Curaçao was not able to take responsibility for that refinery. Two, it was aware of the so-called obsolete state of the refinery at the moment that it retreated. It was aware of the effects, the damaging effects that went off the refinery, but still it maneuvered the whole negotiation process towards a situation, whereas it left, in this case, the weakest party of all parties involved, no other way than to go into an agreement with Venezuela.
Yeah, because briefly, what's the responsibility, according to you, of this Venezuelan company?
Of course, the Venezuelan company is responsible for the damage that it has inflicted as of 1986, when it started. So I will be the last one who will say that Shell is responsible for the damage inflicted after their retreat, but they're certainly responsible for the damage that they have inflicted up to 1985.
Okay. You're granted a ferry too. There she is. What wish would you make if it's with respect to Shell?
May I wish for 100 more wishes?
You've got two. One with respect to Shell, one with respect to your government.
Okay. With regard to Shell, I would wish for them to just respond to responsibility. Shell is very much aware that in case of Curaçao, it all did not went as it should. Shell is very much aware of its responsibility. There are other parties involved, amongst which...
Okay, clear. So take that responsibility. And with respect to your government, is there something you could wish for?
Well, basically the same. Also, they have got to respond to responsibility.
Okay, that's clear. Thank you very much.
Next, we're going to talk to Isaac Atsume Otsuoka from Nigeria. You are a member of the Executive Committee of the Environmental Rights Action. That's an environmental justice advocacy. And at the same time, you're also striving for more democracy in your country because you're a leader of the pro-democracy platform of Nigeria. So you're used to criticizing both government and multinational corporations. Nigeria is a famous case for Shell. 10 years after the death of Kensaro Wiwa, Mr. Otsuoka, how are things in Nigeria?
10 years, thank you very much. 10 years after the murder of Kensaro Wiwa, we have had some changes in Nigeria. At the government level or governance level, we have shifted from having a complete military dictatorship to some level of civil rule, which is not the same or doesn't equate to democracy. Concerning the role of Shell and the activities of Shell, we have also seen some changes in rhetorics. There is now more talk about sustainable development and commitment to social corporate responsibility. We have seen the annual processes of dialogues with stakeholders, which involved big conference yearly in Port Harcourt or Warri, where Shell executives and influential chiefs and contractors meet to discuss community issues and all that. To us, I mean, those are just jamborees. We have also seen a situation where Shell has changed its community development department to sustainable community development. You know, so instead of just community development, they now talk about sustainable community development. But if those changes have reflected positively in the communities, in the fields where they operate, no. My experience is that in terms of the operations of Shell in the communities, they're much worse.
They're worse. They were. So the rhetoric is better and the actual situation is worse?
The actual situation is worse.
Why? Can you mention just one or two problems, just to keep it brief?
Well, first is that the infrastructure that was put in place by the company, particularly the pipelines and the flow lines, are older than they were 10 years ago. And so they are more susceptible to wear and tear. So you have more spills and more blowouts than we had 10 years ago.
Clear.
10 years ago, we were complaining that the facilities were too old, 30 years. Now they are 40 years old, and they are still being used. So we have more, much more spills. Oil activity has increased. You know, there's more oil production, and there is associated problem of associated gas. Mm-hmm. So if you drill oil, you also bring gas and they flare it. So there's now an increase in gas flaring as a result of that.
Gas flaring, just for the Dutch people here, het afvakkelen van gas. That's a thing I wanted to focus on because that's a very clear issue between the community and Shell. Sure. There's a very clear problem here. Yeah. Can you just explain what's the matter according to you?
Okay. The colleague from IUCN made his presentation.
Yeah.
And he talked about the ideological position that markets can solve problems.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this is one clear example of how markets cannot even begin to address the problem. Now, in some places, but particularly in Nigeria's Niger Delta, gas, oil, is associated with gas. So in all the oil fields in Nigeria, there's enormous amount of natural gas associated
coming out
with
mm-hmm.
it. So if you're drilling oil, you also drill gas in the process. So what the companies have been doing, you know, from the beginning, is to separate the oil from the gas at flow stations, and then export the oil and burn the gas off
mm-hmm.
at community level. And these days, Shell argues that the Nigerian government is not doing enough in funding the joint venture funding obligations. That is why they have not been able to eliminate gas flaring. But the fact that we have
because they promised to eliminate gas flaring by 2008. Okay.
But the
whereas it is forbidden.
Yeah.
From, I think I read somewhere, 1984.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a good example of some things Peter van der Graaf.
Yeah. The point I want to make is that gas flaring started in Nigeria before we had Nigerian government.
Okay.
It started during colonial rule. And we have evidence, we have documents from the British archives to show that the company and the colonial authorities knew from the beginning that gas flaring was a serious problem. And there are statements from British politicians.
Okay. But just, they knew, suppose they have known it all along.
Yeah.
And now Shell is aware of it too. So they promised to end it by 2008. It's not, they're not going to make it. They promised now 2009, I guess.
Yeah. Now,
but I just want to talk a bit more about the role of the Nigerian government here. And not back then, but right now. Because you say you have some more civil rule. Are they doing anything to end this?
Okay, before I talk about the role of the Nigerian government, let me explain why the markets will not solve the problem.
Yeah, okay.
Now, while you have associated gas, which has been flared, there's also even more non-associated gas resources. So there are a lot of gas fields in Nigeria that are just pure natural gas that is not associated with oil. Now, this is easier to drill and export. So we have a lot of gas investments in Nigeria, even for the LNG that have been advertised, the Bonny LNG and the other LNGs that are coming. Most of these gas projects are designed to use non-associated gas, which is cheaper for them to produce. So if we're going to follow the market considerations, there is absolutely no market incentive to use even a minor amount of associated gas, except there is concrete.
What kind of incentive would help to use it?
There is, I mean, to end gas flaring, there has to be regulation.
Okay.
You know, and the company has to be asked to stop the practice.
Okay.
It might mean making some additional investments in providing the associated gas gathering infrastructure. But they have to be asked through rules.
And your government,
does
your government ask Shell to do this?
Unfortunately, no.
Okay, why not?
Because we have a very reckless and most irresponsible central government in Nigeria. And all they are interested in is whatever revenue they get. And they buy into the argument from the oil company, Shell, that if they are going to stop gas flaring, it means that they will disrupt oil exports.
When I hear this, I think it's time for your two wishes. One to your government and one to Shell.
My demand or wish to
you should take care with fairies, huh? If you do demands, bad things will happen.
Okay.
Wishes.
My wish, and I now wish for our government, first to the host government, which is the Nigerian government, is that they should recognize that the states that they represent should, you know, protect citizens. And they should make laws that are enforceable that do protect citizens, protect livelihood, protect, you know, the economy. Also, our wish is that the home government of Shell, including Netherlands and the UK, should make rules, you know, binding rules that regulate the activities of such companies wherever they are operating.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we'll swap. We'll swap the organization now. I mean, if you go to your seats, you'll definitely be invited to participate in discussion afterwards. We're still waiting for Kees Vendrik, because he's the politician who's supposed to be here to be in this debate with us. He's about to arrive, I think. But nevertheless, I suggest we just start with Bert Fokkema, inviting him over here, and Pieter van der Gaag. Well, let me introduce them to you. Pieter van der Gaag, you already saw him. He's of the World Conservation Union. And Bert Fokkema, he's issues manager for Shell. Warm welcome to you. Mr. Fokkema, was that a good example? Did these people give a good example of the difficulties of corporate social responsibility?
Well, these personal stories are always... very much around the corner, and they really drive messages home. I think for Shell, it is important that that people, everybody here, realizes that we do take these concerns of communities very, very seriously, and we are working on the things that are being brought to our attention.
And Mr. van der Gaag, because you were talking about there's no lack of laws, you said, but there's really a lack of maintaining them and enforcing them. Was this, for example, Nigerian case a good example of it?
I think it's one of the school examples of it, of a government that has, you could say, difficulty to enforce their laws. There's, I dare to say, also corruption in some of these instances that are part of the causes why things are not being enforced. So, yeah, absolutely.
I just want to ask to Mr. Fokkema, you had a shareholders meeting today. Was corporate social responsibility mentioned? Was it an issue today?
Well, clearly, we had many guests. We had about 1,000 people in the room, and all the people on the front row were here. And I think that they got quite a bit of time to raise their issues, and I think to many of those they were responded from behind the table.
But was it also raised by the shareholders?
Yes, there are several shareholders who are interested in this type of thing.
Mm.
Yes, definitely.
Because there's always a tension between these corporate social responsibilities and other things shareholders find very important, such as profits. How is that treated on a day like this?
It's a good example that that a company like Shell gets many opinions about what it should be doing and what it should not be doing. In general, comparing maybe economics and CSR type issues, but even within the CSR type issues, there are different people with different views.
Mm-hmm.
So you always have to balance those views off.
You're never doing things right.
Your words.
Okay, we're trying to find out whether binding legislation is necessary and whether it is possible tonight. Let's start with Mr. van der Gaag. Oh no, I think something completely different. Let's start with Mr. Fokkema here. Mr. Fokkema, do you think Shell needs binding legislation, and if so, on what level?
Well, legislation, people think that companies don't want legislation, and interestingly, it can many times be the opposite. Legislation develops a very clear framework. It tells you what to do. It protects your ownership. It sets out tax laws. So legislation is something that we very often want when we enter into a country.
You want it very often, but do you also want it in this area?
And it sets the rules clear for where you enter a country, and it creates this certainty in the longer term. And that's what big companies want.
Could explain this a little bit. What do you need the certainty for? Because what's your problem with the uncertainty today?
Uncertainty is mainly related to making investments. Many of the projects that we do or the businesses that we run do require lots of investment or people who are working in it, and you want to make sure that the things that you build up are with you for a longer period of time and they're not taken away from you unexpectedly. So that's what I mean with the longer term.
Yeah, well, let's look a bit closer at this, because the difficulty with uncertainty is, you say, about risk. Does it also have to do with that there's a problem if you are very much of good intentions and trying to be socially responsible, socially accountable? Does it create a problem for you with regard to your competitors?
Now, let's look at I think the way legislation stacks up against all the other things that you can do first. Because we were talking about the basics.
Mm-hmm.
I said at a basic level, legislation can really help. But there are also other things that maybe are developing, and I think then we are starting to approach CSR, where maybe we are still thinking about how to capture this in legislation so that you actually get something that works in the end, that it starts to deliver results. Because legislation is effort for companies, effort for governments. So if you do something, you want to do it right.
What are the other things you're missing? The other things that are developing that are until now missing in legislation you just mentioned?
I think I was talking about CSR legislation,
mm-hmm,
there. And I don't think it's for Shell to say we need legislation or not. I think it's a development that happens into society where society says we now need more rules on ABC, in this case maybe CSR,
mm-hmm,
different letters, and then it's for governments.
Why is it not for Shell to say we need legislation?
That's not our role.
Why not?
No.
I can imagine that you could need it, in the sense that then it's clear for everybody, these are your responsibilities, that's what you are accountable for, which could make it easier.
It could do, if you get it well defined, and under those circumstances, yes. We could go down that route, yes.
Okay, because I remember that in the UK, Shell, together with other companies, asked the Blair government to be more progressive in creating legal standards for doing business.
I don't know about that example.
Do you know that example, Mr. van der Graag?
No, not that one.
Okay, then we'll skip that one.
But maybe others do, in the room.
Sorry?
Maybe others in the room do, because I don't know it. But
Do you know a case that corporations asked a Western government for more legislation?
No, actually, I'm involved in one, and some other organizations here are too. It's about trading illegally logged wood. The Dutch Union of Wood Traders is asking with Dutch NGOs for a prohibition of the importation of that stuff.
And why do they?
Because they have decided that they do need to protect their economic resource base, protect forests. They need to do that through some form of more sustainable logging. And they're being outcompeted by basically stolen wood. All these traders need to pay for is the barge shipping wood over. They don't pay any taxes over the wood that they've cut down. They don't have to deal with proper management systems, which cost money. They just ship the stuff over and sell it here. And 60% of our wood is actually illegally logged that we buy in our stores. So it's a big problem for wood traders who are trying to change.
So wood traders need a level playing field.
And they're asking for it.
They're asking for a level playing field. They need all the companies to have exactly the same framework to operate within.
And I have to say, I was surprised by that, because in my experience, in my previous work around those global systems, the biggest problem we had was with the unions of corporations arguing against everything that we're trying to accomplish. If you talk to a corporation like Shell, they'll say we'll need regulation. If you talk to other big corporations, they'll say the same thing for the level playing field, to also quiet their shareholders who are concerned about profits, because Shell isn't playing the dirty game and then therefore making much more profits. They're already making quite a few profits, but they could be making more, so to speak. We need that legislation, and we continuously run into lawyers representing all the corporations of Europe trying to present that.
But aren't you addressing your baggings to the wrong people then? That you shouldn't be at Shell's desk, but then you should be at the unions of corporations desks, the lobbies. You should address
the ones who own those lobbies, mm-hmm, are the members, and those happen to be the corporations.
So then how do you explain this? Because this is a contradiction, of course.
It's called the lowest
one
common denominator.
One plus one is not two, you say.
No, it's called the lowest common denominators. Okay. What these unions have to do, they have consensus-based rule systems. And if there is no consensus, you keep stepping down, down, and down, and down, and down, until you get something where everyone agrees to. And that is usually not something that we need.
Let's ask so. Mr. Fokkema, because he must be experienced, perhaps, with this mechanism. On Shell itself is putting forward its social corporate responsibility, but Shell was also in the International Chamber of Commerce. It was presiding it, if I'm not mistaken. In such an organization, are you striving towards more rules or more self-retainance on this area, this field?
I think the question that you ask and the comments that you make help to illustrate that it's not one or the other, but it's kind of a stack of things that you need in order to start to get developments in a certain area going, and in this case then CSR. Legislation would very often be the lowest common denominator. That's what you end up with through the forces that are being described here. And I think the other thing with legislation is that normally it's sort of 10 years behind. So you never get something progressive out of legislation, in my opinion, from that just because of those two factors. Industry bodies can be useful because through leadership of maybe some members, you do actually, let's say, drag the laggards up to certain standards. And industry bodies have the power to maybe build in their own thresholds.
Tell me about the role of Shell in industry bodies.
And I think that you do see that Shell takes leadership in several areas as a company. And we are pulling industry along. Maybe just one example that springs
Please.
To mind that I heard about recently. IPCA, the Oil Industries Industry Association, is starting training on human rights. That is pretty unheard of. That human rights, 83 of the big oil companies are in there, not all the front runners, are actually now apparently starting to consider that this is something that they should think about. And that was a long sentence starting to consider, but that's much more than saying, this is not my business.
Okay.
Yeah, but let's have, once again, a closer look at this. This biggest obstacle, as you described, with this union of corporations. Because what exactly is that mechanism then? Of course, you are competitors, but together you are in a union, because, of course, you share some interests, otherwise there would be no union. Then what's the mechanism? Isn't there something like a peer review mechanism, like countries sometimes do, that you can push the other to come in your direction? Or does everybody face the prisoner's dilemma?
Well, I don't know, again, about your example, and I'm not aware of a specific example where we are in that we're trying to push something along in exactly the same way like you're describing.
Okay, then put it more simple. If you are in a business, you've got your competitors, you've got BP, you've got Exxon, Mobil, etc. If you move forward, you're a front runner. Shell is known to be a front runner with presenting its eighth social report already. If you move one step further, do you consider yourself, as we say in Dutch, your neighbor's fool?
How does that translate?
I think everybody knows what I mean.
I don't.
Well, we've buurman's gek.
Altijd goed, zijn buurman te krijgen.
No, you didn't get a vote on that one, I'm afraid.
you really didn't get it. No, so but then, do you put yourself on a competitive advantage if you move one step further in taking social responsibility?
Do you win?
I wouldn't put corporate social responsibility and competitive advantage as a reason to do it. I think the reason we do it is that
there's no relation between those two?
I think the reason we do it is that we need a license to operate from the people that we work with or work next to, our neighbors, or the people who have opinions about our companies. And at the same time, there's difficult circumstances that creates and that we can experience on in that allow us to, yes, get a competitive advantage over companies who don't know how to do that.
Let's invite him immediately on this table.
No break.
Case Fendrick, he made it. Let me give you just a brief introduction. Welcome to start with. Could you do with some water?
Case Fendrick is a member of Dutch Parliament for the Green Left Party. He just came from The Hague, working right on. We are here talking about legislation and big corporations, whether binding legislation concerning corporate social responsibility is necessary.
And we were just talking about a very interesting point that Mr. No, I'll just switch it on to you immediately. Mr. Fukuma, I asked Mr. Fukuma, is there a connection between taking more social responsibility than your competitors do and competitiveness? Does it either put you at a competitive disadvantage because you incur more costs, or will it put you at a competitive advantage because you can gain in, say, consumer loyalty, things like that? Mr. Fukuma, you stick with your point that there's no relation between social responsibility and competitiveness?
I stick to my point I was trying to make, is that you don't start corporate social responsibility because you want to have a competitive
advantage. No, but that's a different thing.
But if you know how to do it well, then you do get it. That was what I was trying to say. Mm.
Do you see a relation between those two, Mr. Vendrick?
Just give me some time to enter this place. I just finished attacking Mr. Zalmay, the Minister of Finance. It's a whole different business.
Is he still breathing? Or?
He still is, yes.
Oh,
I'm sorry
is.
To
okay.
say, but he still is in power, anyway.
Okay.
So the question was...
Okay,
the
once
relation
for the third
between
time.
Competitiveness...
Because yeah. No, if you're Shell, if you move one step further than your competitors do, could you incur a competitive advantage, either a competitive disadvantage? So is there a relationship between competitiveness and social responsibility?
Or is there a tension?
I think both sides are possible. I think when corporations start to think about corporate social responsibility, they don't really believe that it will enhance their competitive position. I think most companies, like Shell, for instance, started to think about corporate social responsibility because of external pressure. Look at the Brent Spar affair. So I think that's the starting point for most companies, just to avoid loud noises about corporation policy. But at the very same time, I think most corporations who does practice some kind of corporate social responsibility, most of the time they see their profits rising when they do so. So I think there's a difference between the starting point and most experience when they started.
Okay. Does it have an effect, for example, on the financial market? Because maybe investors will fear litigation and then choose for a company that's very aware of its position in society? Mr. Fukuma? Yeah, I'm asking to you because you know most about shareholders' value, I suppose.
Thank you for quoting me as an expert on that. This is a moving field of and a moving area, and increasingly you see shareholders interested in the area of social responsibility, where it's still only the sustainable investment funds that really use it as a benchmark, as a criterion, which is still a very small amount, but it's growing and growing and growing. It still isn't very big because it was so small. But also the normal institutional investors are taking increased interest.
But still, we Dutch newspaper readers read in our newspapers in February that Shell shareholders, after the problems Shell faced, somehow stopped, asked the CEO to stop this, well, I'm not quoting here, but to stop this green bullshit and look at the profits again.
Many people ask different things. If you had been at the shareholders' meeting, you would have heard questions about why we spend so much money on wind energy,
mm-hmm.
Because it's the cheapest way to actually get rid of your money.
Mm-hmm. The basic line is that shareholders, according to, naive newspaper readers, are just interested in profit. Is that true? Or can you also say that within, amongst circles of shareholders, there is some kind of shift, that also shareholders start to become interested in other issues than money just by itself?
Yes, it's the latter.
It is.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Van der Graag, yeah, you had a comment.
On the competition thing, I know from the financial markets, from investors, the idea that if corporations do not take the sustainability aspect seriously, then they start to see it as a risk. It's very little right now, but it's growing. So the idea that if a corporation isn't acting sustainably, isn't dealing with its license to operate, the risk grows.
Okay, and what actually is the risk?
That the corporation gets either regulated away or consumers stop buying stuff.
Okay.
But this is strange because consumers, on the other hand, you hear more and more of corporations, and they thought about this one, and they've done their market research and their focal groups and their advisory boards and whatever. They are many corporations are no longer profiling what they're doing. It's not me. As my phone is over there. As corporate responsible, they don't. They don't profile themselves like that. They want to profile their product as something that's good, that has a good quality and a good, you're cool if you use it, on those aspects and not on its environmentally sustainable and socially just. So you see a lot more companies moving away from using that as a marketing advantage.
Okay.
Because they figured if you come in, I have a CSR product, you get a niche market that is interested, and the rest seems to want to ignore it. So there's a very interesting dynamic there that we haven't understood yet. So.
Okay, let's switch from the corporate dilemmas to the responsibility of governments and international legislation. Let's start with Mr. Vendrik, because GroenLinks and the Dutch Labour Party, Partij van de Arbeid, have made this proposal for a law on corporate social responsibility, I hear. This was in 2001.
Yes.
And this law is still somewhere in a drawer, or what happened to it?
I'm afraid so, yes.
Okay, tell us briefly what happened to it.
Well, the story is quite simple. Until this very hour, we didn't find any majority in the Dutch parliament in supporting this bill proposal.
How come?
Well,
what are they afraid of? What are they not interested in?
Sometimes I do think they are not interested, but anyway, I think there are two main reasons. Politicians these days, most of them, not all, don't like international regulation. First of all, the rule of law isn't so popular as it was, let's say, 10, 20 years ago. So, and at the very same time, the second reason is the firm belief of most political parties that corporate social responsibility is a new issue. I don't think it is, but anyway, for them it is a new issue. It has to be developed by corporations and societal organizations like Greenpeace or Amnesty International. There has to be some kind of international dialogue, confrontation. So we leave it to society. There is no specific role for national governments to gather together.
Okay, but why are they so afraid of international regulation? What's the problem with that?
Well, I don't see a problem, so I have
no,
to speak for
them. But you mean your colleagues, because you say, I can't find a majority.
Yes.
So what are your colleagues afraid
work.
Of?
That's what they say. It doesn't work.
It doesn't work. It is
so
necessary.
We just don't try.
Corporate social responsibility is
they're
a new
afraid of
issue.
Work.
It has to be developed in the marketplace. Give space to the corporations.
So what we have here is a dilemma that the politicians are waiting for the companies and the companies are waiting for the politicians.
Well, I think most multinational corporations are not waiting for politicians. I think they keep this problem very silent. And the strange effect is that, on an international scale, we don't organize a level playing field. At the same time, organizations, employee organizations on a national scale constantly ask politicians to organize a fair market, to organize a level playing field between competitive organizations, competitive business corporations.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a strange difference between the national debate on issues of employment, on environmental policy. We constantly
investment
have to
climate.
Be aware of a
uh-huh.
fair marketplace. But internationally, this argument doesn't
So there's
play
a
any
gap
role.
Between national and international
yeah.
legislation. Mr. Van der Graag, well, do you agree here? Or
it's the religion of neoliberalism. You have to have faith that things will happen, and some politicians have that faith.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some bishops who are proclaiming it very much, and we all follow them because it's easy. We will
get through it, and then at the end,
but
everything
now
will
you
be
presume,
fine.
But I'm being, no, but being now you're presuming that they think it will actually happen. Do they think it will actually happen, or is that an argument and they don't really care?
I think after so many years of economic theory telling us it's best not to regulate because the market will handle this, many people believe so. And as I said, in 2004, it was only last year, the OECD, which was the temple of this faith, said, it doesn't work. We need to do something else. And they've actually been recommending these same governments now don't use voluntary approaches anymore because they don't work. I think
so
that's a very fundamental
on the European
new thing,
level, you see a small change here.
Well, the OECD started arguing for neoliberalism in the 60s. Mm. In the 80s, they got it. So in 2004, they argue for the different approach. And so in 2024, we'll have it. But who is the OECD? It's the rich countries. It's the 31 mm-hmm. rich countries. But that, in the way the world works, those are the ones who decide. Sorry, but that's just how it is. And thank God, recently in the WTO, we're starting to see changes in the group of 20, in the group of 77, are now becoming demandeurs. They're trying to set the agenda. I was going to say something else, but I forgot.
Things
but
are going very slowly.
They are, but
to some extent, they are. Uh-huh. They went the other way. I mean, the OECD was the forum in the 1990s. To think about a kind of global agreement on investment. An investment agreement which was binding to all governments to guarantee free movement of capital. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the dominant thinking within the OECD. So you can't think at the same time about a kind of world regulation binding national governments and at the same time proposing some kind of international rule governing multinational corporations. I mean, the first item was much more popular and much more coherent with neoliberal thinking. Also, within the WTO, freeing international trade is a dominant issue. It still is. Some changes have been made and some struggles have been won, especially in Cancun. Mm-hmm. But the main paradigm within the WTO is freeing trade. Get it rid of rules, mm-hmm. not imposing new
rules.
Okay,
so we'll come and talk about the WTO later. Well, yeah, because that's an important thing. But let's get back a little bit to the to this OECD thing, OECD being the richest country in the world. What countries actually, if you look at the global scale, what countries are actually in favor of regulation? Is the Nigerian government in favor of international regulation?
Are they? I don't know. I know Tuvalu is.
Is your government interested in international regulation?
I mean, they will agree to anything the World Bank and IMF tells them. So, the question is no. The World Bank and IMF, you know, in favor of international regulation? No.
I was just thinking, because if it is that the rich countries are not interested in regulation, what about the governments of poor countries?
No,
are they?
At the World Summit for Sustainable Development, there was a clear move from the group of 77, which is 120 poor countries, to support the, at that time, Friends of the Earth campaign on corporate accountability. They wanted stuff in the text on it. It got killed by the United States, who just had elected Bush, and the European Union didn't want to be part of that. What they actually wanted was language in there that all environmental and social legislation should be consistent with the WTO, which was thwarted again by the group of developing countries. So that process, and that's new process in the WTO, we're now seeing it really developing. Cancun went wrong because of that. I think lots of developing countries are getting into this debate, have figured out what their power is. You talked about power today, Bobby. And are starting to use it more and more, and that is helping to change it. But yes, they are still dependent on their loans from the IMF, from the World Bank, and us, and we have still this agenda. But even that is changing, because we're talking about corporations are bad, but I'm working with a lot of corporations who are changing their minds too. And that is gaining more and more momentum. I talked about the wood traders, yeah. Which I think in the Netherlands is a very clear example. They have actually decided to kick out the bad guys, which is a new thing for unions of corporations.
Stick for a second with this example of the wood traders, because is it possible in the Netherlands to introduce a certificate on certificated wood so that is...
Well, it should be. If you use our interpretation of the WTO, it has to be, and there should be no objection. But our Ministry of Economic Affairs apparently has a different interpretation of the WTO, and they say it isn't possible, and hence it's being stopped.
So then what happens? So the wood traders, they want a certificate, because that will prevent all the illegal lodges to bring their wood in.
They
apply to the Ministry of Economic Affairs, and they say... No.
It's a bit difficult. What the certificate does, it helps custom officials recognize which stuff is bad, which stuff is not. Because if you get a log coming in, you cannot see by the log itself if it's illegal or legal. You need a piece of paper. So that's all that does. And even getting that certificate is, according to our Ministry of Economic Affairs, WTO incompatible. I disagree. I don't think that's the case.
And they fear WTO regulation.
So they even stop the thing in their tracks before it becomes legislation.
They use WTO regulation.
They abuse it.
This
they use it not to have to do anything.
They use it to avoid any kind of regulation.
Yeah, because I argue...
It's another initiative of my colleague Marijke Vos, who proposed to label wood with a red sticker. Do you call it in English?
red label.
Bad wood and a green one, good wood, like FEC. And the battle is still between my colleague and the Ministry of Economic Affairs finding out whether it's WTO proof or not. And of course the Ministry of Economic Affairs try to avoid
this regulation.
Okay,
so that's interesting, because why would they avoid it? You say, well, they just point to the WTO and that will give them a good excuse, but you say, in fact, they don't want themselves. Why are they so...
Well, because they are part of this big international conspiracy.
This big international conspiracy? Are we back in?
I mean that's it. No, come on. Okay, let me get. Okay, let me be more serious. I'm sorry. I very much like our Minister of Economic Affairs. Anyway, no, I mean that's the traditional part they play in Dutch politics, like in many countries. They are the ministry of the corporations. They are trying to free the market. They are trying to get rid of subsidies. They are trying to get a neoliberal agenda.
Mr. Fokker-Mazzi, right.
That's the traditional role most of ministries of economic affairs plays in these countries. So they do in Holland at the same time.
So they're bouncing the ball. When they have to do something, they bounce it towards the international bodies. And the international bodies...
For example.
Have other reasons and other interests in not coming up with some legislation. Then what happens? Maybe Shell itself should just propose some kind of sticker for good oil and bad oil.
Is there a difference?
So pretty black in the end.
No. If there's no legislation, I'm joking but also being serious. If there's this gap, and there's an eternal strain between international legislation and national interests and national legislation, then the companies themselves get back the ball.
Yes, and I think that's what we're doing. I think you see then that some companies pick up that ball and run with it, and they see where their responsibilities are, they're acting on it, and they also see what the opportunities are that creates. Mm-hmm. And I think Shell is one of those companies where we're looking what the challenges are. We're talking about CSR, but you see similar challenges in energy, energy challenge for how we're doing that in the future. And Shell is one of the companies who says, okay, not right now, but we see that this is an opportunity and something we need to do in the next 20 years. So we started to play that ball already.
Let's try and find one specific thing here and see if we can come up with some kind of solutions. The most simple thing here, if we look at Nigeria again, with its rather... let's say, not completely honest government, the easiest thing would be if the Dutch government came up with some kind of legislation for Shell not to misbehave in other countries. That's perhaps what NGOs also would like. Would Shell apply to such a legislation? Would you agree with it? Or would you say if we supply to Dutch law, they cannot ask us to behave in a certain way in other countries. We behave in Denmark in a different way than we behave in Durban, for example.
The national legal requirements can be really difficult and create a dilemma, because there, if you have if you, because I think we're talking about Western international legislation here,
mm-hmm.
and what we think is normal can be perfectly abnormal somewhere else.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, I think the example is probably around the Middle East, around religion, where we think religion should be free. And everybody with whatever religion they have exactly the same benefit.
That's a clear example. But an example regarding Shell.
And Shell happens to operate in a number of countries in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
So you would immediately facing that dilemma if there was legislation around that particular issue. So does then the Dutch government, because we talk legislation, so we talk to the government, the Dutch government then says to, let's pick a country, Iraq, your law is wrong. We know how to do this. But that, does that sound right?
Yeah, but I was just going to ask that. For example, let's talk about a concrete example here. We have you have pipelines in Denmark which have rust detection, and I read in the alternative report that the pipelines in Durban do not have that rust detection. Shouldn't the pipelines in Durban have the same treatment as the pipelines in Denmark?
I think the simple answer is they will.
Okay. And when?
And
when will they? Do you know
and
that?
And we are working on it.
Hmm.
And the work has started.
The work has started. Do you have some kind of deadline here?
And we have been in a situation today and also in the press where we say certain things that mm-hmm. are being said around what we do are coming from a different view in the report Lessons Not Learned and from some of the stories that we hear today. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those examples.
But is there what is the point then? Is there a gap between what Shell says and what it does? Or is there a gap between what Shell does and what communities expect? Do they expect too much from you?
Oh, there's always an issue around expectation within Shell, outside Shell, from governments. It's constantly something you have to manage. I think it's another thing that people say about Shell, they just organize dialogue and talk shops. Mm-hmm. And actually, our experience is you do need those to understand what the expectations are, so that if you start to work, that you challenge those, channel those, and that you actually start to work on the things that matter. That matter to the people around you, and that you know you can deliver.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about quickness?
Speed.
For example, speed. Yeah. In Nigeria, where this since 1984, the gas flaring has been forbidden, and of course the government does not control this very well. But at the same time, Shell has not been able to stop this gas flaring. What is the problem here? Is this a logistical problem? Do you not have money enough? Or do several communities ask different things of you? How come?
Well, Nigeria I find a very difficult subject to talk about
mm-hmm.
because it is very difficult for Shell to operate there
mm-hmm.
and it is very difficult for the Nigerian people to live there, and there are many things that are so completely different from what you see when you walk out in the street here that and that I have no experience on, that I have to be very careful what I say.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm saying. The other thing is that I've read in the press that there may be a lawsuit against Shell from the organization from Mr. there, and so that also means that you have to start to weigh your words. And it's an interesting by-effect of when you want legislation. Because legislation, I think, is wanted because people want to actually go for the accountability of
mm-hmm.
companies.
Access to justice,
and
one of the main
things.
What
then unfortunately happens is, then what I think will happen is, that it's me not sitting here, but it's a lawyer. And he doesn't say anything. And there's no dialogue, and it's the end of the story.
So you already feel like you're being in court, I understand.
Well, we're not in court. We haven't been served.
But to be on the safe side, you pretend you are.
But I just want to give that as an illustration, and now we can go back to your question.
Well, you just say that if the communities just ask to stop gas flaring, then it will happen sooner than if they sue you. But somehow it hasn't happened yet.
No, the gas flaring, there were several technical issues and market issues that couldn't be stopped at the time that, whenever.
What kind of market issues are we talking about then?
Apparently, there is for the gas. There is no local market, and the technology at the time was not available to actually collect the gas, do something with it, so that it could go somewhere.
Okay. What I'm really curious about, Mr. Fukuma, according to you, where do you think the key is to to sort the problems that still remain today?
The key is, well, I think that's what many of the people heard this morning also in the meeting, that the key is that we need to continue, and thinking of Shell problems here, we need to continue to work together, understand what needs to be done, and then tackle those issues. And the people this morning did hear from the senior management that there is a clear commitment and that we are making progress.
Listening
to additional concerns.
Well, yeah, but I was saving you from this because I was talking about, you know, how do we get to binding regulation. So where's the key to get your competitors on the same ambition as you are on responsibility and accountability? Where should we, as a community, start to change something for the better? Let me move to Mr. van der Gaag, because you already mentioned the OECD has just recently discovered voluntary self-regulation, it doesn't work. What is the OECD now planning to make a change for the better?
Well, the OECD is a group of countries, right? So they're not planning anything yet. The research is being done, and then what works? If regulation doesn't work, the voluntary approach doesn't work, they're taking that next step, then what does, and they're going for the middle way of incentives and that kind of stuff.
I hadn't that clear yet. The OECD thinks regulation doesn't work either, or it's not an option?
Yeah, they've thought so for 40 years, and they haven't let that go yet, as I said earlier. But just coming back on what Beth said, because I think that's a very important point. What we think here is good for the world may not be thought of the same in other parts of the world. There's cultural differences, and I agree. But what I was saying in my presentation is that the work has been done at the global level. And the question is, how globalized are you? If we're dealing with globalized corporations, there are actually universal norms. This is what this UN Commission has done. They figured out what we have all agreed to, which people in Togo agree and people in Iceland agree to, universal norms, and they are applicable to corporations. So it is not so much the cultural difference here that counts. We have agreed this is what needs to be happening. What we have also agreed, what we also have figured out, is that there are many countries who either cannot implement through corruption, through lack of capacity, whatever, and that there is a role for northern governments who can.
Okay. Well,
that's where the binding bit comes in. Should we require our corporations to follow those universal rules? I would say yes.
Okay, so stick it but then for it a moment a with that, because then we move to Mr. Fukuma. Reading your social report you presented today, I found this quote saying, "We oppose the draft for this UN proposition on human rights for business." Could you explain a little bit on that?
Yes, that's true. We did that, but you have to see that against the background of leading work, I think, around human rights in this case, trying to develop what responsibilities are, trying to understand some of the dilemmas, work with that, and training a company internally on dealing with that. When it came, and this goes back right to the start of the conversation, when it comes to legislation and international legislation, I think like in this case, then we said we need good legislation, which is specific, it's very clear what's right, what's wrong, what needs to be done, what needs not to be done, and how you measure that.
And it needs to be precise.
Thank you.
Okay.
And on those terms, we didn't think that the UN norms were the right thing.
The UN norms were not precise enough, you say? Well, just to have it clear, because, I mean...
They were very precise in words, but I don't think they were... They are precise in...
What should they have been more precise on?
In terms of who determines... who is the judge on it? So it was not right law in that terms, and also, and I've got to be a little bit careful because this happened before I started this work, which you probably start to figure out by now, and also that they aren't specific enough to say in the end, say that people start to come for their accountability, this was, they did it wrong, yes, they did it wrong, or they didn't do it wrong.
Because Mr. Van der Gaag, who should be the judge according to the UN on these cases?
They actually assign it to national courts. If I'm
national
right,
courts.
Right? I'm looking at the Amnesty people. They know most about this. Yeah, national courts. He has a point. I think some of the principles described in the UN norms are very difficult to argue for in national points. I'll take the precautionary principle as my best example. If you go to a judge saying Shell didn't abide by the precautionary principle, then how are you going to prove that? Because what the precautionary principle means, if I should explain it, it means that if there isn't enough scientific evidence, if there is a reasonable thinking that something shouldn't happen because there could be irreversible damage, you shouldn't do it. All these are sort of vague terms. This will work in a WTO panel, because then you're dealing with legislative processes and all kinds of stuff, but this will not work in front of a judge who will have to fine or jail someone, because then you need some exact terms of why that person is going to jail. And not abiding by the precautionary principle is a difficult one. And there's a few more.
There were more corporations like Shell opposing to that draft.
I think at least all their unions are. So, so then, yes, if they're still part of those unions, they are. So, yeah. But also, most governments. I haven't found a government yet, at least not in my part of the world where I operate, even the Swedes, who are very progressive on these issues, who support these norms in getting them adopted, regretfully. But that's just the reality.
But then again, we have this problem of one waiting for the other, because then we don't have an international set of norms, because industrial bodies are opposing it. They don't think it's right. And on the other hand, we have national government waiting for international norms. Maybe we go to the WTO, because that's a body a lot of things are being treated. What do you expect of December, Mr. Vendrick? Then there's a big WTO summit. Do you think anything in this field will be attained there by the developing countries?
No, I'm afraid not. One of the positive aspects of the European Union's agenda on the WTO were the social and green issues, non-trade issues, they were officially called. It was a kind of a separate agenda point from the European Union. But they removed it because they weren't successful in drawing attention to the importance of these theme. So they stopped talking about it and promoting the agenda of non-trade issues.
But are they at the WTO? Are they aware that they can be an obstacle for example, a certificate on good wood?
It's not the main agenda. I mean, the WTO is a fighting place for the European Union, United States, and for most the G20,
mm-hmm.
on freeing the international agricultural market. I mean, that's the big theme. And that's the big fight which has come to an end in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And there are several other agenda points, like the GATS, like the NAMA issues.
But this will not be one of them.
But the focus of everybody has been drawn to the agricultural issue.
Okay.
Are the European Union and the United States prepared in the end to get rid of export subsidies,
okay.
to stop subsidizing the national
agriculture?
So that's
not the WTO, there's no hope there either. So that's...
It should, but I think realistically
speaking,
it's not
going to
happen. It won't be part of the agenda in Hong Kong.
It brings us back to the Dutch government again. So
yeah.
There we have the ball bouncing around.
Yeah.
Maybe you're an opposition politician, but just to speak for politicians, what would a move be that would help here? One political move to oppose?
Well, we tried 1 year ago,
mm-hmm.
a different proposal, the Green Party together with the Social Democratic Party. Because following the international scandals, like the Enron scandal and the financial scandals on the internet in Wall Street, in Holland, a kind of code of conduct,
mm-hmm.
for good governance of companies has been set up, the Code of Tabak
Tabaksblad, yes.
And it's a kind of semi-law, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
Companies have to say, we comply with the Code of Tabaksblad,
And if they don't, they have to explain why they don't.
Mm-hmm. Reporting.
So, mm-hmm. And when the code came out and was published by Mr. Tabakspot, who used to be chairman of Unilever, so a famous guy, the Dutch government couldn't wait one day just putting a signature on it and give it a some kind of legal status. And we said to the government, well, isn't a way of using a new code of conduct concerning corporate social responsibility, Tabakspot-like, just set up a kind of binding rules for national corporations operating on an international scale, and we ask them to comply with these rules, very basic principles, and if they don't, well, they are asked to explain why they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a kind of proposal, kind of compromise. But at the very same time, the Dutch government didn't like this proposal. So it was a kind of move without any success. And, well, there my pockets are empty, so to say.
Your pockets are empty. Because I think we're rounding off now a little bit, because I know the people in the audience are very eager to put some questions forward. Your pockets are empty, you say? Do you have something more in your pockets unless, you know, you continue
to
on...
To give to these people?
Yeah, to give to these community members?
I think that if we feel there are areas around CSR where we are sufficiently sure we can package it in legislation that would help companies and people, that we would participate in the development of that.
At what level are you then thinking about? UN, no, national levels...
Well, I think we were talking national here.
You're going to make an appointment
If you go higher, it probably gets even more complicated. Mm-hmm. And I think we were discussing that that's where the problems were.
Okay, you're going to talk with Mr. Brinkhorst. And your pockets, what's in it for the solution we're looking for tonight?
In my pockets? Oh. Well, we'll continue to work on it here. But I think the WTO needs to fix their problem, and that's just one. I think the Dutch government and politicians should force them to do that, should take many more risks. They shouldn't wave this WTO flag. Just take the risk, see what happens. You know, on the importation of illegally logged woods, I have to see the state that's actually going to challenge that. Who's going to challenge the importation of that the importation of illegal stuff should happen? I mean, that way we can go to US, import our XTC or our weed, because here it's legal, you don't like it, but that's just the way it is. We're not going to do that either. So that's a ridiculous position. That should happen. So on these universal norms, we should just take some risks and do our job in trying to get them implemented. What we are doing, because I really do believe that the issue is a little bit more complex than what the OECD guidelines tell us or what the UN norms tell us. We are actually working with these guys. We're working with the Nutreco, which is a terrible company in the Netherlands on fisheries, to try to figure out how to do it best and how to try to figure out some solutions and try to figure out what really will work. Because honestly, we don't know it either. NGOs seem to claim that we do, but sometimes we really don't. But we are motivated by what's going wrong, and we need to keep arguing for getting that changed. That's all I have to offer.
What we surely need is audience pressure, public pressure, and I guess we have some right here.
Okay, yes. Remember what we're talking about. We're talking about these dilemmas and the problems, so we're not getting into any tribunal. You've got a question too?
Yes, I want to say something about that. I think actually that the issue of Shell, the case that we presented here, makes clear that we actually need the international binding regulation. And I don't think that the pockets of Mr. Vendrick are actually empty. Because as we all remember, last year there was the RIVM report, which showed actually that Dutch people are more concerned about deforestation than their own pension plan. And I think, you know, that Dutch people, it was also in the report, they don't agree with the neoliberal agenda, and they don't want the government getting away from the market, you know, drawing away and letting the market solve the problems. They actually want the government to take more control. So actually, I think now it's time to make a good strategy and to come together, both the political parties and the NGO, and come up with a good example, because I'm sure that if we have the right proposals, that we surely can win.
You're going to make a... You're going to make an appointment later on.
I was wondering whether we could have the Peter van der Veer code.
Jeroen van
der Veer. Jeroen van der Veer. Sorry. Jeroen van der Veer code. Want zijn of
in English.
I'm sorry, in English. The code of Jeroen van der Veer. Because why don't you take up that idea that GroenLinks, the Green Party, and the Labour Party couldn't do because nobody in the Parliament wanted to do it. But I'm sure that if Shell and Unilever and all these other big corporations suggest a code on social corporate responsibility, which is either binding if you take it and otherwise you explain why you don't follow the rules, why don't you start that? Why don't you take that initiative tonight?
It's not quite up to me, but thanks for the suggestion.
Now I can inform you on that question, because before laying down this proposal in the Dutch Parliament, we had a meeting with several people, business people amongst them, including Shell, and we asked them, please, Dutch business leaders, would you take the initiative? Because that's how it went with the Code of Tabaksblad. It was an initiative from corporations gathering together and drawing these code of conduct on. So would you be so kind to take this initiative to make a code, just do a suggestion, and then we can find a kind of a legal binding procedure like the Code of Tabaksblad. And Dutch corporations are not interested. They won't take the initiative. You ask them, they don't do it. Well, anyway, I don't know. I don't think there is a...
Let's have a reaction of Peter.
I just want to add something to what Bert said. Because last Wednesday we had a meeting in Nieuwspoort, which is near the parliament. He was there, and several other people were there. And we talked about the role of government in achieving these things. And he joined with us, and Shell then, I guess, joined with us, that we do need a more active role of government. So he's being quite modest, but they did do it. So they're not completely silent all of the time. Some politicians were there to hear it, too. Okay.
An urgent question here, I guess.
Yes, thank you. I will try, but, right, first of all, my name is Maura Harrington. I come from County Mayo in Ireland, in the west of Ireland, on the periphery of Europe. But yes, we still think we have some contact with it, becoming more tenuous as Shell moves in. I would like to offer a comment on tonight's proceedings.
Could you briefly, please, briefly?
Well, when I consider that I am one of this group of people who met this morning at 7:15 to travel to the Shell AGM in The Hague. Some of us we have had a very full day. We have to go back to our hotels and... Yes, my comment has a lead up, as I would hope that I would have the same... just an end of the time that I've sat here. I think we people here along this front line are a prime example of where things are going wrong. We are the people who are living with the reality of corporate worst practice. We don't like Shell spin. We know the difference between Shell rhetoric and Shell reality. Now, perhaps everybody here, and I'm sure all the very good people up there who have come to hear a genuine discussion on corporate social responsibility and the role of government and the role of NGOs and the rest, might please consider that the people here from Ireland, South Africa...
That's clear. But, so please make your...
We were invited here. We were invited to come here. Now, for what reason are we here other than to sit like dummies for the past 2 hours? The very issues you are essentially waffling about are the issues which impact directly on us. And I will end... I would rather not see a smile or a smirk on that person's face. I can only hope it's a nervous tick.
Okay, that's enough. I
have one question for Mr. Fokkema. Will he explain to this meeting here tonight why Shell in Ireland is first of all destroying a greenfield area for the sake of a few dollars more rather than process their gas properly offshore? And will he explain, which he can't, because he spoke about a license to operate from their neighbors. You have not got a license to operate from your neighbors in County Mayo. You never will, because nobody in their right minds, having met these people here, would allow you anywhere. And for the record, it was not nearly 1,000 people who attended the AGM. It was 676 per ad Jacob.
Thank you very much. Your point is clear. I thought we were asking not to have a tribunal, but okay, now it was a good point and it's clear. We'll continue with a question.
Yeah, okay. Afraid of what might happen, I suppose. Well, I do think that, you know, it is quite important, certainly, to have this confrontation. I think that our colleague from South Africa had said it very well, that Shell Corporation didn't change until the South African government took the responsibility for holding Shell to account. And I guess my question, really, is also to you, sir. I forgot what organization you're from, but you seem to be focusing a lot on the international community and what the international community should do. And I'm a human rights lawyer, so of course I believe in universal human rights, otherwise I would pack up my bags. But I also realize that the only thing that has proven to really make change has been national actions where the companies are based. Shell Corporation didn't change its activities in Nigeria and in apartheid South Africa until there was action here in the Netherlands and in Britain to push them to change. And I guess my question to all of you, don't you think that the most important focus is really here in rich countries where the companies are based, that we should be focusing our advocacy?
Okay, thank you. That's a clear question. Mr. van der Graag?
Yeah, well, the last point that I made was that there are these universal norms. I think it's very difficult for Western governments to impose their culturally motivated views on all of the world, but there are universal norms, and we have a role to help enforce them. And if that means that we need to talk to our own companies that emanate from this region and tell them this is what you should be doing, then that is what we should be doing, and that is actually being recognized by our governments, but they just don't add that extra little bit, which is the actual transparency, access to justice, and whatever else you need to get it actually forced. That is the political discussion that we're in. Why do I focus on international norms? Because I'm convinced of the first. I don't think we need to be imposing our views on everyone in this planet. And second, we're dealing with a globalized planet, and I'm sort of someone who believes in that, and I do want to go into that direction, that everyone has a say in what happens on this planet and not just a few people in one particular country.
I also think that the people here on the front row are the proof that public pressure is a very important factor in changing behavior of both companies and governments. I have a question here from South Africa.
No, sorry.
Okay, you pass.
Okay, I'll take coffee from.
I have a question. In the United States, you've got a so-called Alien Torts Claim Act.
Mm-hmm.
That is a law that provides foreigners the chance to, if an American company violates norms abroad, those foreigners can come to the United States and file a lawsuit against that United States company within the United States based on United States law.
I see.
My question would be, if the government says on an international level to seek the solutions there, that's too difficult, let's stay close to home. If companies say, listen, it's something that we have got to resolve at home. If NGOs say, well, maybe the first step is, let's do it close to home.
I guess what you're heading for is...
Then my question would be, what is the problem to introduce some sort of an Aliens Claim Tort Act in the Netherlands?
Mr. Vendrick.
Well, it's becoming a well-known story, I'm afraid to say, but we did propose this a few years ago to the national government, and they refused because they said, well, our perspective is different from the United States. We are a small country. If we want to impose such a law, we do have to do it on a European level. And
Yeah, well, it's the same old story, I'm afraid to say, but that's not the agenda of the European Union. Just to get new rules on multinational corporations, I'm very afraid to say so.
But do you agree with me then that the ending conclusion is...
But you agree with me then that the ending conclusion is that there is no sufficient will to resolve the problem?
Yes, there is a lack of political will, and that's... That's what I meant when I said a few minutes ago, my pockets are empty. I'm really waiting for new elections. I mean, there's a big gap.
Okay.
No, that's
okay. No, but
just let me explain it briefly, because the other remark was focused on my point as well. There is a big gap between expectations of the Dutch population on the social climate, on whether we need a liberal revolution in the Netherlands and Europe or not. Most people don't want a neoliberal society. But at the very same time, they vote in favor of a majority in the Dutch parliament just carrying out that project. There is a big gap. And I see, I just have to wait from a parliamentarian point of view, just for new elections. There is lack of political will. Most political parties don't want any regulations, don't find it a very interesting theme. Shell is doing fine. Let the multinational corporation do their job, and we see that there's no role for the Dutch government. And that policy hasn't been changed in the last few years.
Okay, I'm taking a question here.
Yes, thank you. But if I understand you correctly, you just said that it's not for a company to ask for legislation. My question is, wouldn't this mean that a company should not oppose the development of regulation and legislation? So, for instance, wouldn't it be strange then in this, if you follow this argument, that Shell opposes the development of the UN draft norms for human rights and business?
Mr. Fukuma, this one's for you.
No, it is society and governments that decide on whether there's a need for legislation, and we are part of the process of developing legislation, and there should be quite a big gap in between where you're discussing sort of what does it look like, what are you trying to achieve, can you actually do it? In certain cases, there's cost-benefit, probably not in this case. So yes, we would engage in that debate of developing legislation. And if that goes into a direction that we think, and we talked about sort of what are the criteria for good legislation, if it goes into the direction that we can't tick the boxes on good legislation, then we will oppose it.
We've got three more questions. The first one, South Africa again.
With due respect to my colleague from IUCN, Rach, I think the reality is, and the apartheid regime and the Dutch government's very strong, the Dutch community's very strong resistance to that was that I'm black, you're white, but we suffer the same consequences when we're damaged. And in terms of international law, Shell's exceedances of air pollution standards in South Africa that are harming children will not be allowed here. Now, I'm tired of debating in a very formalized, in a very polite forum. The reality is that people are dying. My mother died. My three rugby friends died. My niece died of cancer. Our benzene levels are at 50 parts per billion, which will not be allowed here. And that's the intricacies. And it's interesting to see a lawyer here to be able to work through that intricacies. So I think the reality is that we all suffer the same, and we're fooling around with politics about how we make these changes happen. I just want to go back to my fairy godmother's wish, power. Let's change that.
You've got a question.
Yes. I have a question to Mr. Fukuma. I would first like to make two observations. After hearing the stories, the local case studies, your reaction was, it's always interesting to listen to personal stories. I think that was kind of underestimating the value of these case studies. These are not personal stories, but stories from communities. The other is that when we go from a more abstract level to concrete local situations, you kind of seem to avoid the subject like the Nigeria, it's a very complex situation and things like that. And from me, just from common sense, you think like Shell could invest in alternatives for flaring of the gas. So my question to you is, would you tonight to involve yourself personally, you as an issue manager of Shell, in addressing all the stories in the report and address here tonight within Shell, so then after 1 year we can come back to you and ask you what happens inside Shell with all the stories presented here.
Okay, that's a good question. And what I would like to say about that is that I think within Shell I could bring together an audience like you see here and have the same conversation where people say, we should be doing more, we should be doing less, what's happening, are we really doing what we should be doing, are we going far enough? So Shell is a hard shell, like the pictures that you see when you look at it, but it actually is a company of people. And the things that we do are developed by the dialogues also that we have internally. And I can assure you that the stories this morning in the shareholders' meeting were back to our colleagues in several places in the world this afternoon to discuss what sort of responses we need to give on this. And I don't mean responses in the BA or PR way. And I meant when I said Shell takes the community work very seriously. And these are the sort of examples that I can give you about that.
A question here. A question, please.
César, do Brasil.
I'm César from Brazil.
Eu acho que até o pessoal não sabe que existe Shell no Brasil.
A lot of people might not know that Shell is in Brazil.
Que tem 25 empresas no Brasil, só o grupo Shell.
There are 25 companies connected to Shell in Brazil.
Que é um país maior do que toda a Europa junto. E só na questão estatística de contaminação dos 3 mil postos de gasolina da Shell, chega a 25 milhões de brasileiros.
That's a country bigger than Europe, né? And that's the contamination, the pollution only created by Shell, the 3,000 gas stations of Shell, contaminates 25 million people in Brazil.
And your question is?
Que... O que a Shell Mundial planeja na sua plataforma no Brasil?
What does Shell International plans in its base in Brazil
to do about this contamination? Okay.
About everything.
That's a hard one.
Yeah, I guess.
That would be a very detailed answer. I think, just help me, is Pandakan in the Shell report? Sorry.
Brazil.
That's Brazil. Okay. Well, I can't answer the question in that case.
Okay. Well, I think it's
we've got one more question here.
Okay, you
That's
take one
the
last
one. But why can't you answer this question?
Because I don't know what I don't know specifically. I hear what the gentleman is asking,
yeah.
But I don't have the details. That is, and I don't know the answer to the question. So that's the reason I said I can't answer.
Mr. Fokema is not the person to address on this issue, I guess.
Listen, I think we're rounding up now because we're rounding off with the final question to Mr. Fokema. Look, we see that the people sitting in the front row, of course, they're very grieved and, you know, they suffer and their community is suffering. And I presume that Mr. Fokema really doesn't like these stories either and is really eager to see them resolved too. I mean, it's sad and it's sad for everyone. But Mr. Fokema, what would help you to make sure that, say, in 5 years' time, you come here again, I hope, because we're still very happy you're here. You come back in 5 years' time. What do you need not to have these questions anymore?
Okay, that's actually quite simple. Then we need to continue to dialogue with these people in order to work on the real issues and get them sorted. Because Shell's never said that things are perfect. we're not spending several hundreds of millions on these refineries to improve things, to cut down emissions, and to work on many of the things that you have already raised. So we're on a road to improvement, and we need to continue to stay on that road in order to reach the goal. And we need to continue to talk to each other in order to determine what the goal should be. So that's what I would like to do then over the next 5 years.
Okay, Mr. Vindek, you want to comment on that?
Should it be of any use that left-wing politicians will visit your shareholder meeting next spring, or just to help Jeroen van der Veer to prolong his good
thinking.
Works?
Everybody's welcome. Are you a shareholder?
Well, I can buy some stock. I mean,
okay. I think we should finish. Let us thank you very much for your attention, for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Vendrick, Mr. van der Graag, and Mr. Fokma. And, well, keep up the good work, everybody.